One former intelligence official recounted briefing the Congressional Intelligence Committees about the secret destruction of videotapes showing harsh interrogations at CIA black sites. "I went to the Hill and told them the tapes no longer existed," the official told me. "Now, I said they no longer exist. I did not say we crushed them up. It was up to them to figure out the rest." The briefing was truthful, but coy. The interrogation videotapes did not just disappear in a flood or get lost in the bureaucracy. Jose Rodriguez Jr., the head of the CIA's clandestine service, ordered that the tapes be pulverized in an industrial-strength shredder in a cable he sent with detailed instructions. Though two agency lawyers told him they saw no legal obstacles, Rodriguez sent the destruction order without the approvals and over the objections of the CIA director, the Director of National Intelligence, and the White House legal advisor. "After scrutinizing the cable on my computer for a while, I thought about the decision," Rodriguez later wrote. "I took a deep breath of weary satisfaction and hit send." Rodriguez was officially reprimanded by the CIA for violating the chain of command. This was the rest that congressional overseers had to figure out by themselves. Intelligence officials admit they parse language to reveal only what they must, especially in open or unclassified hearings, not because they're bad people, but because they're good intelligence officers who are trained to protect rather than disclose. "I readily concede that people like me can be too prone to keep too much hidden," wrote Michael Hayden. Former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper agreed, writing, "As someone who had been in or around the intelligence business for the better part of 7 decades, transparency felt genetically antithetical to me." But keeping too many secrets from Congress can backfire, undermining trust and public accountability. Only the intelligence committees can say to the American people, "I don't have a dog in this fight. I'm not part of the executive branch. I've looked hard at overseeing the intelligence community's secret activities, and I am satisfied they're doing a good job." Agencies must strike the right balance between secrecy and transparency. That's getting harder as information about everything becomes more available and public expectations of openness rise. In March 2013, Director of National Intelligence James Clapper got into hot water when Senator Ron Wyden asked him whether the National Security Agency collected any type of data at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans. Clapper said no, but the correct answer was yes. After 9/11, NSA began several new intelligence collection programs under the codename Stellar Wind. One involved the bulk collection of telephone metadata, the time, number, and duration of phone calls made by millions of Americans. The idea was to build an archive of who called whom that could be queried for possible connections to known terrorist phone numbers. The program did not collect the identity of callers or the content of their calls. Still, it was massive. It targeted Americans, not foreigners. And it was a major departure from how the National Security Agency's authorities had been interpreted and used in the past. NSA, after all, was an organization that collected foreign intelligence, eavesdropping around the world. Some believed the terrorist threat demanded relaxing the divide between foreign and domestic intelligence collection. Congress's 9/11 joint inquiry found the government's weakness in monitoring communications between suspected terrorists when one party was already inside the United States left the country vulnerable to attack. But others, including some inside the intelligence community, were deeply uncomfortable with using the National Security Agency's vast surveillance capabilities on Americans. "The standard we grew up with was no U.S. persons," said a former intelligence official. "That made me squirm. I lost sleep over that," It wasn't illegal, but I lost sleep. When Edward Snowden revealed details about the National Security Agency's metadata program, opposition grew. Congress eventually passed legislation effectively ending it. Clapper says he misspoke that day, thinking Senator Wyden was asking about a different StellarWind program that targeted foreign communications content. "I made a mistake, but I didn't lie," Clapper later reflected. "I've been to the Hill many times over 25 years. I've answered probably thousands of questions, either orally or in writing. It is incredulous for anyone who knows me to think I would say, 'Gee, just for a change of pace, I think I'll lie on this one question in an open hearing. Really?'" Wyden, however, thought Clapper had been deliberately deceptive. Clapper didn't help matters when he later told NBC's Andrea Mitchell that answering no was the least untruthful answer he could give. In some sense, this was technically accurate. The hearing was open, and answering yes would have publicly revealed a highly classified intelligence program that had already been briefed to Congress in private. But the political damage was done. After the Mitchell interview, all hell broke loose. Clapper offered to resign. Misperceptions spread. Americans thought the National Security Agency's metadata program was eavesdropping on their phone calls with relatives and tracking their every move, when it wasn't. NSA leaders tried to explain, but few believed them. In a national poll I conducted in October 2013, I found that more than half of Americans thought the National Security Agency was lying about the metadata program. 30% weren't sure, and only 17% thought the National Security Agency was telling the truth. Had agency leaders leaned more toward openness earlier, the National Security Agency might have avoided this distrust spiral. Michael Hayden, who came up with the StellarWind programs when he was the NSA director, later wrote, "We mishandled congressional notification, not constitutionally, but politically. We kept the circle small for noble reasons, to keep the secrets. But politically, it was a mistake, and strategically, it led to a loss of political and, more important, popular support for what we were doing." Another former senior intelligence official agreed that it was a major missed opportunity. There would have been no outrage of, "Wow, what's NSA doing?" if we had brought Congress into the tent, he told me. "We could have gotten anything we wanted after 9/11. We didn't have to do it in that semi-clandestine way." Electoral incentives. Executive branch secrecy is a large part of the oversight story, but it's not the only part. Congress also ties its own hands because voters reward them for it. Let me explain. All of us respond to incentives. We pay more attention to some things than others depending on the rewards. If I told my Stanford students they'd all receive A's in my course, no matter how well they did on the final exam, chances are few would study very hard before taking it. For legislators, the mother of all incentives is re-election. As Yale professor David Mayhew famously noted, electoral victory may not be a legislator's only goal, but it is always their primary one, the goal that must be achieved over and over if other ends are to be entertained. The electoral connection is a powerful motivator. It goes a long way toward explaining why legislators, regardless of party or era, typically behave in the ways they do. Committee assignments in Congress illustrate the point. It should surprise no one that the Senate's Subcommittee on Science, Oceans, Fisheries, and Weather is filled with members from coastal states, while the Senate Agriculture Committee has an abundance of members from places like Kansas, Iowa, and Nebraska. Because legislators prefer winning re-election to losing, they seek committee assignments that can best deliver benefits to voters back home. The political calculations that drive oversight activities are less obvious, but no different. Legislators engage in greater oversight the more they are rewarded for it by constituents and organized interest groups, and the less costly those activities are, in terms of time demanded, activities foregone, and expertise required. Understanding oversight dynamics starts by getting inside a legislator's cost-benefit mindset, asking whether the political advantages of any particular action are worth the political costs. It doesn't take much to see that intelligence oversight is an electoral loser. Voters don't care about it. Even foreign policy writ large has never been the most important issue in a presidential election. The intelligence committees cannot send jobs or benefits to the folks back home like most other committees can. Members can't even talk about what they do because it's classified. As one staffer told me, legislators can't go home and hold intelligence awareness fundraisers in the district. Geography also hurts. Because intelligence is a national issue and not a regional one, citizens and groups who do care deeply are dispersed rather than concentrated in a handful of districts. Why do farmers receive huge subsidies each year despite being a tiny share of the U.S. population? Because they are geographically concentrated in farm states whose representatives work hard to get them. There's no farm state equivalent for intelligence, no geographic center of industry or interests that encourages legislators to focus on intelligence oversight to win voter support. As Michael Hayden told me, no member ever gets a bridge built or a road paved by serving on the Intelligence Committee. It's an act of patriotism. Savvy legislators know their time is better spent elsewhere. To be sure, some self-interested legislators harboring presidential ambitions serve on the committees to burnish their national security credentials. But even for them, the greatest benefits come from joining the committees, not actually working hard in them. A few patriotic members do expend considerable effort on intelligence oversight, but they're rare. Most don't, because it's a thankless assignment. Good work remains silent, and public scandals can be politically costly. When intelligence controversies make the news, members often distance themselves by criticizing the very intelligence programs they may have privately supported, and by summoning intelligence officials to hearings on Capitol Hill. For intelligence officials, this throw-them-under-the-bus dynamic can be infuriating. As former CIA officer Kofor Black put it, "Over a 28-year career at CIA, I was never invited to testify before a congressional committee regarding a success." The electoral incentive problem is no secret. Legislators complain about each other almost as much as they complain about the executive branch. One member of a congressional intelligence committee called oversight horrible and gave Congress failing grades for being an independent branch of government. Another lamented, "There are a lot of members, unfortunately, who just don't make that commitment to do the work." An Intelligence Committee staff member told me that in his experience, less than half of all committee members came into the secure office to read the classified committee materials. On one 2006 Sunday talk show, Senate Intelligence Committee Chairman Pat Roberts shook a pill bottle and said he was going to prescribe memory pills for his colleagues who had never objected to a controversial NSA program in classified briefings, but did when the program became public. In 2007, intelligence oversight was so bad, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence held a hearing about itself. The committee asked me to testify. "It's a bizarre experience, criticizing Congress to members of Congress. I tried to be tactful." Former Congressman Lee Hamilton testified too. I can still picture it. Hamilton was deeply respected across the aisle, having chaired the House Intelligence Committee from 1985 to 1987, and more recently serving as vice chairman of the 9/11 Commission. At the time, the commission had a huge media following. Its public hearings were riveting and nationally televised. Its 2004 final report became one of the best-selling government reports of all time and was even a finalist for the National Book Award. During the fall 2004 presidential election, the commission and the 9/11 families received more national television news coverage than the war in Iraq. The commission leveled some of its most blistering criticism at Congress. Hamilton was blunt that day, too. Wagging his finger at the committee, he warned, "To me, the strong point is simply that the Senate of the United States and the House of the United States is not doing its job. And because you're not doing the job, the country is not as safe as it ought to be." Around the room, senators nodded in vigorous agreement. And still, nothing changed. Institutions. In addition to asymmetric information and electoral incentives, institutional features of Congress make oversight harder in intelligence than in other policy areas. In some ways, Congress is perfectly designed for poor intelligence oversight, with rules that prevent the development of expertise, committee jurisdictions that weaken Congress's budgetary power of the purse, and features that exacerbate partisanship in the House. The expertise problem. Congress has many more powdered milk experts than intelligence experts. Of the 535 members serving in the 116th Congress, only 18 ever worked in an intelligence agency. But dozens of representatives came from dairy districts in New York, Wisconsin, Vermont, Texas, and elsewhere. That's better than it used to be. In 2009, only 2 members of Congress had prior intelligence careers. The same year, the Congressional Dairy Farmers Caucus was founded with more than 50 members. As our earlier discussion suggests, expertise is essential for good oversight. The more a committee knows about an agency's domain, the more it can tackle information asymmetry by asking better questions and demanding better answers. In most policy areas like dairy farming, expertise is homegrown. To get elected, legislators have to learn about the industries important to their districts, but not intelligence. Because of electoral incentives, few legislators walk in the door intelligence experts. They have to learn on the job. And yet, congressional rules prevent that too. From 1976 to 2005, Senate rules limited service on the Intelligence Committee to just 8 years. House rules still impose term limits for the Intelligence Committee, but almost no other committees. The result? Just when legislators become experts, they're forced to stop overseeing the intelligence community. Sounds crazy, I know. What's going on? Many argue that term limits were originally designed to improve oversight by keeping legislators from getting too cozy with the spy agencies they were supposed to oversee. But by that rationale, all oversight committees should have term limits to foster greater independence from the executive branch. A more likely explanation is that term limits help party leaders cajole legislators into doing the job. Most members do not consider the Intelligence Committee's attractive assignments. It's a duty, not a perk, sucking up time and delivering little in return. Term limits help solve the problem by enabling legislators to roll onto more attractive committees that offer greater constituent benefits after a few years of intelligence service. Not surprisingly, term limits have created expertise gaps between the intelligence committees and Congress's other oversight committees. The proportion of long-termers, defined as legislators serving for 5 congressional sessions, or 10 years or more, is lower on the Senate Intelligence Committee than the Senate Armed Services Committee or the Senate Banking Committee. This experience gap is even more pronounced in the House. The House Banking Committee had twice as many long-termers as the Intelligence Committee from 1975 to 2020. The Armed Services Committee had 3 times more. Fewer long-termers means more rookies. In the 103rd Congress from 1993 to 1995, one of the highest turnover periods, 11 of 19 House Intelligence Committee members and 7 of 17 Senate Intelligence Committee members were serving for the first time. Although committee tenures have improved since the 1990s, the House Intelligence Committee still has a high proportion of newcomers. In the 114th Congress from 2015 to 2017, for example, just as Congress was reforming the National Security Agency's telephone metadata program and dealing with reports of Russia's interference in the 2016 presidential election, 40% of the House Intelligence Committee members were brand new to the committee and just learning what the acronyms of all the intelligence agencies meant. "Term limits are stupid," noted Michael Hayden. "I don't know why they still have them, but they are hanging themselves." Budget power. Budgetary authority is Congress's most powerful oversight weapon. As former House Intelligence Committee Chairman Lee Hamilton noted, "All of us have to live by the golden rule, and the golden rule is that he who controls the gold makes the rules." But the intelligence committees don't control intelligence agency budgets. The House and Senate Appropriations Committees do. In most policy areas, this arrangement makes sense. In intelligence, it doesn't. To understand why, we need a little background. Congress has two basic types of committees: authorizing committees, which examine agency activities, and appropriations committees, which fund them. Theoretically, this division of responsibilities ensures that authorizing committees develop policy expertise and examine policy issues in depth, while appropriations committees develop fiscal expertise and guard against excessive spending. But this bifurcated system also means that an authorizing committee's power only goes so far. Authorizers can threaten to cut budgets, but appropriators must deliver on that threat. Wielding the power of the purse requires coordination across committees. This is much easier to do in policy areas other than intelligence for two reasons. First, secrecy rules make it hard for one committee to know what another is doing. Second, because intelligence is a small part of the behemoth $700 billion annual defense bill, intelligence committee members cannot object to a spending item without holding the entire defense budget hostage. This budget system is ripe for gaming. Intelligence officials know they can easily bypass the intelligence committees and appeal to appropriators if there are funding decisions they don't like. It's the two-parent approach. If one says no, go to the other. For years, Senate Intelligence Committee members voted to terminate several intelligence programs on a bipartisan basis, but appropriators kept putting them back in. Senator John McCain grew so incensed by this pattern that in 2004, he took to the Senate floor and exhorted his colleagues to approve a resolution granting the Intelligence Committee appropriations power. "If we are going to have a truly effective Intelligence Committee oversight that can function with strength and power, we are going to have to give them appropriations authority," he said. "The appropriations process is what drives not only the money, but also the policy." McCain's bill failed. Other reform efforts have too. Today, the intelligence committees still don't have appropriations powers. Why? Because few things are as sacrosanct in Congress as turf, and few legislators are more powerful than appropriators. In Congress, there are Democrats, Republicans, and appropriators, joked one congressional staffer. So long as the intelligence committees cannot credibly threaten budgetary punishment, intelligence agencies will be less inclined to respond to their demands. Partisanship in the House. So far, we've talked about Congress as a whole. There are important differences that make oversight more susceptible to partisanship in the House than in the Senate. With a few notable exceptions, it's almost always been this way. In the 1970s, the Senate's Church Committee succeeded while its House counterpart collapsed under its own partisan weight. Half a century later, investigations into Russia's interference in the 2016 presidential election followed the same pattern. The Senate Intelligence Committee conducted a serious bipartisan study, while the House Intelligence Committee investigation became mired in partisan rancor. Here, too, institutional factors explain a lot. The House has shorter terms, 4 times more members, and different Intelligence Committee rules, all of which make the House naturally more unruly and more partisan than the Senate. Jane Harman, who served as the ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee, called the House a perpetual election machine, where members are out there all the time running for re-election. Being in constant campaign mode amplifies the rancor. Size does too. As one former House staffer told me, the whole body is different. In the House, it's majority rules. You can shove anything down people's throats. The Senate is a different world. In the Senate, you have to compromise and build relationships across the aisle. The incentives for bipartisanship are greater. Senators know they have to work together to get anything done, and the Senate's slower campaign tempo enables them to do it. You become friends, said Senator Saxby Chambliss. When Senator Bernie Sanders was asked who his favorite Republican was, his answer was surprising. Conservative Oklahoma Senator Jim Inhofe. Jim is a climate change denier. He is really, really conservative. But you know what? He is a decent guy, and I like him, said Sanders, who joked that revealing their friendship might ruin Inhofe's career. Committee rules both reflect and reinforce these differences. Membership is just one example. In the Senate Intelligence Committee, the majority party always has just one more member than the minority. Even if there were 80 Democrats and 20 Republicans, the Intelligence Committee would still be split 8-7. This one-vote margin encourages members to work across party lines. House membership, by contrast, is more proportional, with the majority party getting a significantly greater number of committee seats. Of the committee's 22 members in 2020, 13 were Democrats, 9 were Republicans. The House's membership rules make it easier for the majority to pass measures and conduct business along party lines. In short, Congress isn't just at the mercy of the executive branch. It has tied its own oversight hands through rules that limit the development of expertise, turf protection that weakens the power of the purse, and features that reinforce partisanship in the House. Old weaknesses, new tech. The problems of information, incentives, and institutions are coming to a head as technology advances at a breakneck pace. Information about intelligence is hard enough. Now, intelligence oversight committees also need to know more about emerging technologies transforming the intelligence landscape. A tough oversight problem is getting tougher. In 2013, when I became co-director of Stanford's International Security Center, I went to Capitol Hill and asked, "How can our scholars work with you to improve policy?" The answer I kept hearing was, "Help Congress understand technology better." So my colleague Herb Lin and I started running cyber boot camps for congressional staff from all of the relevant oversight committees in the House and Senate. The staffers were smart, dedicated, nonpartisan, and really worried. Technology was fast outpacing policy, they told us. The divide between Washington and Silicon Valley was a national security risk. Technologists didn't understand the policy world, and policymakers were struggling to understand technology. Intelligence has always been a technical enterprise, with spy satellites, code breaking, and engineering analysis of enemy weapon systems. Today's technological demands, though, are even greater because there are more breakthrough technologies. They're spreading faster and further. They're inherently hard to understand. They're driven by commercial companies seeking global markets, not governments seeking national security. And they are changing societies in ways that are difficult to imagine and impossible to contain. Encryption is a good example. For a long time, encryption wasn't part of everyday life. In 2001, smartphones and social media didn't even exist. Now, encryption is used to protect information in everything from classified networks to internet protocols to cell phones and popular messaging apps like Signal and WhatsApp. Encryption algorithms and related security features are constantly improving. Keeping current on this technical landscape is crucial for intelligence because encryption is a double-edged sword, protecting information for both the good guys and the bad. Finding encryption weaknesses and other coding flaws before others do is vital to national security. So is deciding when to use these vulnerabilities for intelligence gathering or disclose them to the vendor to fix. The National Security Agency's work in this area is highly classified, but public accounts provide a glimpse at just how fast the technical terrain is shifting. In the 2000s, as encryption tools were spreading on the internet, the agency spent billions on supercomputers and other measures to crack them. After Edward Snowden illegally revealed these highly classified programs in 2013, Apple, Google, Yahoo, and other companies raced to develop strong crypto. Companies saw both commercial and privacy benefits to better encryption. New iPhones and Android devices suddenly had default encryption linked to passwords. Yahoo encrypted messages in Yahoo Mail. Instant messaging apps like WhatsApp and Signal began using end-to-end encryption. By 2015, when Syed Rizwan Farouk and his wife shot and killed 14 people in San Bernardino, the FBI couldn't get into his phone. It was an iPhone 5C locked with a passcode that would delete all locally stored data after 10 unsuccessful attempts to unlock it. The FBI demanded that Apple write new software to undermine its own security features and unlock Farouk's phone. Apple refused. A legal and media fight erupted. And according to press reports, the FBI eventually hired an Israeli forensics firm to successfully hack the phone. Encryption has continued to be a furious cat-and-mouse game, with companies developing new software to make products harder to crack, and global intelligence services, forensics firms, and hackers hunting for new security flaws to exploit. And that's just the beginning. Experts fear that within a decade, advances in quantum computing could make even today's most advanced encryption breakable. China is investing heavily to get there first, and Google, Microsoft, and IBM all have major quantum computing initiatives underway. There are plenty of other technological challenges for intelligence. As Chapter 5 noted, artificial intelligence offers enormous opportunities, but it too requires technical know-how to understand the promise and pitfalls, and it too is developing at lightning speed. In 2014, the notion that AI could create fake images so real you couldn't tell the difference was inconceivable. Now it's unavoidable. The code is open, available, and so simple, even a high schooler with no background in computer science can make deepfakes. And we haven't even talked about information warfare or synthetic biology. The point is, good intelligence oversight requires much more technical knowledge than it used to, and Congress doesn't have it. In 2020, Congress had 210 lawyers, but just 32 engineers. There were only 3 engineers in the entire U.S. Senate. When Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg testified before a joint hearing of the Senate's Commerce and Judiciary Committees in April 2018, to discuss privacy issues and Russian disinformation, it was a jaw-dropping moment, revealing just how little senators knew about the products and companies that are transforming global politics, commerce, and civil society. Senator Lindsey Graham asked whether Twitter was the same thing as Facebook. Senator Orrin Hatch asked Zuckerberg, "How do you sustain a business model in which users don't pay for your service. A dismayed Zuckerberg replied, "Senator, we run ads," grinning awkwardly. Even Senator Brian Schatz, considered one of Congress's technology gurus, seemed not to know the difference between social media, email, and encrypted text messaging. As former Secretary of Defense Ash Carter wrote, "All I can say is that I wish members had been as poorly prepared to question me on war and peace in the scores of testimonies I gave as they were when asking Facebook about the public duties of tech companies." The Senate Intelligence Committee has greater expertise than that. Chairman Mark Warner led a successful tech company earlier in his career. But even here, only one other member has a technical background. They face a daunting task. Remember how hard it is to get members to read classified materials? Now imagine they have to understand new technologies being developed in the private sector, too. And nobody rewards them for it. In short, information is getting harder to understand, congressional incentives are not improving, and congressional institutions remain poorly equipped to oversee today's intelligence challenges. While intelligence officials and legislators often do not see eye to eye on much, they do agree on one thing. Congressional intelligence oversight needs help. Oversight has rarely worked well because the sources of dysfunction run deep in information, incentives, and institutions. It is always easier for spy agencies to hide than for Congress to seek. Electoral incentives are powerful things, affecting how legislators behave and the rules they create. Most members don't do the unheralded work of intelligence oversight precisely because it's unheralded. Voters don't care, and interest groups don't reward it. Congressional committees and procedures help members win re-election but reduce expertise, budgetary leverage, and in the House, bipartisanship. In short, both old weaknesses and new technologies are combining to make oversight harder than ever. Chapter 9. Intelligence isn't just for governments anymore. Nuclear sleuthing in a Google Earth world. The more classified something becomes, the less analysis you'll get. Siegfried Hecker, former director, Los Alamos National Laboratory. The fire looked suspicious. The flames were so bright, a weather satellite detected them from space around 2 a.m. on July 2, 2020. Iran's Atomic Energy Organization initially downplayed the news, calling the fire an incident involving an industrial shed under construction. The nuclear agency released a photograph of the damaged building, and Iranian state TV released a short video clip. David Albright got to work, a physicist who founded a nuclear nonproliferation nonprofit called the Institute for Science and International Security. Albright believed that scientists should play an active role in solving international security problems. His team had been closely tracking construction of the suspicious shed for years by analyzing commercial satellite imagery and Iranian official statements and photographs. Meanwhile, in California, a young researcher at the Center for Nonproliferation Studies named Fabian Hines was tracking the fire, too. Using images released by the Iranian government, commercial satellite imagery, and Google Earth, they geolocated the scorched building. On the basis of their nuclear and country expertise, each reached the same conclusion. The Iranians were lying. The shed was actually a nuclear centrifuge assembly building at Natanz, Iran's main uranium enrichment facility. And the fire might have been an act of sabotage. Natanz was well known to United Nations weapons inspectors and American intelligence officials. Located about 125 miles south of Tehran, its vast underground facilities housed thousands of nuclear centrifuges, the advanced machines used to enrich uranium for both nuclear energy and nuclear weapons. For years, the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, had been locked in cat-and-mouse inspections there to collect evidence about violations of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and to monitor Iran's compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal, which allowed only limited uranium enrichment for peaceful purposes. Natanz was also the site of the most sophisticated cyber attack ever conducted. Codenamed Olympic Games, the joint U.S.-Israeli cyber operation destroyed approximately 1,000 nuclear centrifuges by secretly injecting malware into their operating computers. Experts believed Olympic Games slowed Iran's march to the bomb by a year or more. But Albright and Hines weren't employees of the IAEA or the U.S. intelligence community. Armed only with open-source information and home computers, they were analyzing and shaping an unfolding international crisis. Within hours of the blaze, both were on Twitter and giving media interviews. By 8 a.m., ABC News was running their analysis. By mid-afternoon, the New York Times was, too. By nightfall, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was asked whether Israeli sabotage was responsible. "I don't address these issues," he curtly replied. This is the new world of nuclear sleuthing. Tracking nuclear threats used to be the province of secret agents and analysts at high-powered government intelligence agencies. Governments enjoyed a near monopoly over collecting and analyzing threat information. Now, open-source information and connective technologies are enabling independent researchers and individual citizens to do it too. This community is an eclectic mix straight out of the Star Wars bar scene, with hobbyists, journalists, activists, professors, students, profiteers, volunteers, former government officials, and more. Nearly all harbor an obsessive interest in nuclear secrets and finding creative ways to unlock them. This chapter takes a deeper dive into this emerging world, examining how American intelligence agencies have estimated nuclear threats in the past, what factors are changing the game, and the benefits and risks of this non-governmental intelligence ecosystem. Why focus on nuclear threats? Two reasons. First, no set of dangers is so often overlooked by the public, but so important to intelligence officials and policymakers. To many, especially those who grew up after 9/11, nuclear weapons seem like Cold War relics. But ask American foreign policy leaders what keeps them up at night, and you're sure to hear something from the nuclear list of horrors. Proliferation to countries like Iran, North Korea, and Syria. The risk of conflict between India and Pakistan, two nuclear-armed neighbors. A Middle East war against nuclear-armed Israel. America's eroding nuclear deterrence in Europe and Asia. Alarming nuclear modernization by Russia and China. Nuclear terrorism, nuclear accidents, and the risk of miscalculation and accidental nuclear war by the United States and others. Humans face three foreign policy challenges that are truly existential: global pandemics, climate change, and nuclear annihilation. Only the first two are top of mind for most people these days. Second, nuclear threat intelligence constitutes a tough test for my argument that emerging technologies and open-source information are fundamentally challenging U.S. intelligence. Tough tests are analytically compelling. The idea is that if something seems true in the most unlikely conditions, then it's probably true in the likely conditions. Frank Sinatra's hit song, New York, New York, captures tough test reasoning beautifully. If you can make it here, you can make it anywhere. Nuclear intelligence is a tough test because it's an area where we'd most expect secrets to matter and spy agencies to dominate. Estimating nuclear dangers has always been one of the most important intelligence missions, from Germany's race to develop an atomic bomb in World War II to North Korea's recent nuclear provocations. It's also an area where clandestine tools really matter. Nuclear proliferators go to great lengths to hide their activities, secret capabilities, from satellites in space to spies on the ground, are all the more important for discovering them. Yet even here, I find that intelligence agencies are losing their advantage. David Albright and Fabian Hines have company. More people in more countries are accessing open-source information and emerging technologies to track illicit nuclear activities. Intelligence isn't just for superpower governments anymore. Hard targets, estimating nuclear dangers. Nuclear intelligence falls into four broad categories. First, understanding the capabilities of known nuclear states like Russia, China, and North Korea. Second, understanding the spread of nuclear materials or know-how to non-nuclear states like Syria or terrorist groups. Third, understanding nuclear accident risks, such as the 1986 Chernobyl disaster. And fourth, preventing strategic surprises like the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis or the 1998 Indian nuclear test, which caught U.S. intelligence officials so off guard they learned about it from an Indian press release. How well have U.S. intelligence agencies done? It's hard to say. Nuclear activities are especially challenging because countries work so hard to conceal them. During the Cold War, the Soviet Union built three plutonium production reactors underground inside a mountain. Khrushchev's secret operation to deploy nuclear missiles to Cuba in 1962 employed a deception operation so elaborate, planning documents were hand-carried to a tight inner circle, and even ship captains carrying the missiles were not told their final destination until they reached the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. Saddam Hussein hid some of his facilities in a large palm grove and buried telltale power line connections underground to obscure them from overhead reconnaissance. Assessing the record is also difficult because intelligence failures are public and well known, but successes are often silent or obscured by events. Everyone remembers the U.S. intelligence community's flawed Iraq weapons of mass destruction assessments. But almost nobody remembers how U.S. intelligence succeeded in getting Libya to relinquish its nuclear, chemical, and missile programs around the same time. Intelligence was the key that opened the door to Libya's clandestine programs, noted CIA Director George Tenet in February 2004. He was right. In the fall of 2003, the CIA discovered that Pakistani scientist A.Q. Khan was planning to illegally ship uranium centrifuge parts to Libya as part of his worldwide nuclear smuggling operation. U.S. officials had the ship interdicted and, together with British intelligence, confronted Gaddafi with the evidence. American intelligence officials went on to play a major role in assessing whether Gaddafi's expressed desires to give up his WMD programs and rejoin the family of nations were sincere. By December 2003, they successfully engineered Gaddafi's abandonment of his nuclear ambitions and rollback of his missile program. It was a success indeed, although 8 years after Gaddafi came clean, the United States and its NATO allies became embroiled in Libya's civil war. Gaddafi was killed, order within the country unraveled, and the Libyan nuclear success story faded in the face of subsequent policy failures. Sometimes, even intelligence improvements look like failures. When a 2007 intelligence estimate reversed earlier findings and concluded Iran might not be marching toward the bomb as fast and furiously as analysts previously believed, criticism came from many directions. Some accused the intelligence community of sabotaging the administration as it sought a harder line, including international sanctions, against Iran. President George W. Bush called the language eye-popping. Others questioned why the intelligence wasn't known earlier. Some wondered if the new judgments were compensation before the mistaken assessment in Iraq. Almost nobody considered the possibility that the analysis changed because intelligence agencies got their hands on new and better information. In short, estimating nuclear threats is hard. Assessing the intelligence track record is too. Humility is in order. The scorecard: what academic analyses find. Most studies of nuclear threat intelligence look at individual cases in isolation, examining what intelligence agencies got right or wrong about country X or event Y. The 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis is the granddaddy of them all. It's the most studied event of the nuclear age. Academics have written so much about that eyeball-to-eyeball moment, there's even an article about why we should stop writing articles about it. More recently, however, studies have started to look across cases and history. This research finds two important things. The first is that the intelligence community's track record is mixed. Using declassified archives and other sources, two leading scholars examined 17 cases over 60 years in which countries tried to acquire nuclear weapons. In three cases, U.S. intelligence agencies correctly identified what was happening and when. Intelligence officials underestimated foreign nuclear programs in five cases and overestimated in nine. This is a useful overview, but it has problems. The biggest is the study's demand for pinpoint accuracy, a standard that is often unhelpful and probably misleading in the real world. For example, the study labels a 1959 assessment of France's nuclear test an overestimation because the actual test came 3 months later than expected. China's 1964 test was labeled an intelligence underestimation because the detonation came 10 weeks earlier than anticipated, according to declassified documents from the time. These timing differences may not indicate intelligence failures at all. Sometimes other factors unknown even to foreign leaders themselves can change the timing of events. In World War II, for example, Eisenhower decided the Allies would land at Normandy on June 5, 1944. Bad weather ended up delaying the invasion 24 hours. Had German intelligence analysts estimated that D-Day would be June 5th, they would have been wrong. But not really. Intelligence estimates can look erroneous in hindsight, even though they were correct at the time. The second and more interesting finding is that intelligence agencies are prone to overcorrection. Underestimation of one nuclear threat can lead to overestimation of the next. One study found that overestimating Iraq's nuclear weapons program in 2003 led American intelligence officials to approach Syria's suspected nuclear program with skepticism a few years later. Israeli intelligence, on the other hand, took the opposite approach, viewing intelligence about Syria with greater alarm. Why? Because the Israelis had been burned for underestimating Libya's nuclear program just a few years earlier. Each was overcorrecting for past analytic mistakes. In the Syria case, Israel's more urgent judgment lens paid off, leading to the discovery that Syria was secretly building a nuclear reactor after all. In short, research is moving toward a better understanding of how well American intelligence agencies have estimated nuclear dangers over time and why. The problem is that these retrospective studies are better suited to understanding the past than the future. Although intelligence agencies are still critical players in the nuclear threat assessment landscape, they are no longer the only critical players. Technological advances are democratizing the collection and analysis of intelligence, with potential far-reaching implications for American intelligence and the future assessment of nuclear dangers. The democratization of intelligence. Three trends have democratized nuclear threat intelligence collection and analysis: rising commercial satellite quantities and capabilities, the explosion of connectivity and other open source information on the internet, and advances in automated analytics like machine learning. Low-cost eyes in the sky. Governments of major powers used to corner the market in nuclear-related intelligence. In the early Cold War, the United States flew U-2 photo reconnaissance airplanes over the Soviet Union to try to ascertain how many nuclear missiles and bombers the Soviets had and where they were deployed. In 1960, America's Corona satellite program ushered in the era of remote sensing from space. Corona was essentially a large camera sent into orbit that photographed areas over the surface of the Earth and returned film in a parachuting capsule that had to be captured in midair over the Pacific Ocean to be developed. The first 13 missions failed, but the 14th struck gold. Corona's first success provided more coverage of the Soviet Union in a single mission than all previous U-2 flights combined. Albert Whelan, the CIA's first Deputy Director of Science and Technology, remarked, "It was as if an enormous floodlight had been turned on in a darkened warehouse." Satellite imagery quickly became the cornerstone of nuclear arms control verification, compensating for the lack of reliable on-the-ground intelligence inside the Soviet Union. The Soviets soon followed, developing a Corona counterpart named Zenit 2, which returned its first usable photographs after several failed attempts in 1962. While imagery resolution improved and the first commercial satellite made imagery publicly available in 1972, the U.S. and Soviet Union continued to dominate the space market, each operating a small number of large spy satellites that were the size of a bus, cost billions apiece to design and launch, used highly advanced technology, and produced classified information. In the early 2000s, technological advances and commercialization opportunities converged, giving rise to a dramatic increase in the capabilities, quantity, and number of small satellites operated by private firms. The first Corona satellite had a resolution of 12 meters, which meant that the image could not distinguish between two adjacent objects on the ground unless they were at least 12 meters or 39 feet apart. In the 1990s, the first commercial satellites offered sub-10-meter electro-optical imagery. In 2000, one commercial satellite had sub-2-meter resolution. By 2019, there were 25 commercial satellites offering sub-2-meter resolutions. Most of them, 19 of the 25, offered resolutions under 1 meter. And starting in 2014, with the WorldView 3 satellite, the sharpest commercial imagery available was 31 centimeters, or about 1 foot. According to Frank Pabian, one of the world's leading imagery analysts, 31-centimeter resolution constitutes a 900% improvement over what was available just 15 years earlier. With resolutions that sharp, an analyst can detect manhole covers, utility lines, building vents, and even different car models driving on a road from space. Other improvements in satellite capabilities include video, which can facilitate observation of dynamic activities like vehicle movement, construction, and nuclear facility cooling plumes, and synthetic aperture radar, or SAR, which enables imaging even in cloudy weather through dense vegetation and at night. SAR can also detect otherwise imperceptible microchanges of the Earth's surface over time, enabling better detection of hidden nuclear activities, such as underground tunnel construction. Satellites are not just getting better, they're getting more plentiful. According to then-Director of National Intelligence Daniel Coats, the number of satellite launches more than doubled between 2016 and 2018. In 2018 alone, 322 small satellites, about the size of a shoebox, were hurled into space. The Paris-based firm Euroconsult estimates that more than 8,000 small satellites will be launched between 2019 and 2028. Although most of these small satellites are used for weather and communications, the number of imagery satellites is growing too. For nuclear-related intelligence, increasing satellite quantity has a quality all its own. The more commercial satellites there are, the shorter the lag time between images captured of the same location. That allows for more finely tuned before and after comparisons of suspect facilities or geographic areas, potentially capturing on-the-ground activity that would not otherwise be observable. Some companies are already moving into the high revisit rate market, offering constellations of satellites that offer lower quality resolutions but higher frequency imaging. San Francisco startup Planet, which was founded by former NASA employees in 2010, has more than 150 satellites in orbit and offers imaging of any target up to 2 times a day at 3-meter and 72-centimeter resolution. Seattle-based startup BlackSky has 4 imagery satellites in orbit and plans to eventually build a 60-satellite constellation capable of revisiting the same city every 10 to 15 minutes with sub-1-meter resolution. Perhaps the most revolutionary change in satellite imagery is that just about anyone can use it. The cost of acquiring satellite images has plummeted from nearly $4,000 per frame to as little as $10. Some high-resolution imagery is free. Anyone with an internet connection can access Google Earth, which has satellite and airplane overhead imagery with resolutions ranging from 15 meters to less than half a centimeter. Google Earth also offers applications to conduct analysis, including 3D building modeling of facilities in its Earth maps and historical satellite image comparisons dating back 35 years. In short, commercial satellites now offer low-cost eyes in the sky for anyone who wants them. Connectivity. More information available to more people. The second major trend democratizing nuclear threat intelligence is the internet, which has powered an explosion in open source information and the connectivity to make it widely available and shareable. In 2000, approximately 15% of the world's population was connected to the internet. Today, more than half the world is online, and more people are estimated to have mobile phones than access to running water. Connectivity is turning everyday citizens into intelligence collectors, whether they know it or not. There's also metadata, such as the time, location, and equipment used to take a photograph posted online, downloadable 3D modeling applications, and community data sharing sites like OpenStreetMap, which allows users to post their GPS coordinates from their phones. All of these capabilities offer new clues and tools for nuclear sleuths. As discussed more in a minute, the online information ecosystem is making possible exciting new opportunities for societal verification or open crowdsourcing to assess nuclear threat information. But it is also making deception easier. In the new online ecosystem, information anywhere can go viral, regardless of its quality or credibility. Automated analytics, machine learning, computer modeling, and more. Large increases in computing power and training data over the past decade have spawned the creation of publicly available machine learning techniques that can analyze massive quantities of data at machine speed. Once algorithms are trained on a dataset to look for certain patterns, they can process thousands of images faster than humans by orders of magnitude. For nuclear threat intelligence, machine learning techniques offer particular promise in analyzing satellite imagery of known missile sites or facilities to detect changes over time. In 2017, for example, U.S. intelligence officials from the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency asked researchers at the University of Missouri to develop machine learning tools to see how fast and accurately they could identify surface-to-air missile sites over a huge area in southwest China. The research team developed a deep learning neural network, essentially a collection of algorithms working together, and used only commercially available satellite imagery with 1 meter resolution. Both the computer and the human team correctly identified 90% of the missile sites. But the computer completed the job 80 times faster than humans, taking just 42 minutes to scan an area of approximately 90,000 square kilometers, about 3/4 the size of North Korea. As noted in Chapter 5, machine learning also holds promise for faster sifting of large quantities of written information, everything from trade documents that might suggest illicit financing schemes to the metadata of photos online, such as the date and timestamp on the picture, the type of camera used, the software that processed the image, and where the camera was placed when the picture was taken. In addition, computer modeling is enabling analysts to better understand the specifications and functions of structures already built. Online crowdsourcing is offering promising new avenues too. Already, thousands of citizen scientists have successfully sifted through massive quantities of data to help a Caltech and UC Santa Cruz team identify several new exoplanets, and an international team of physicists identify new gravitational lenses. In 2016, Melissa Hannum at the Center for Nonproliferation Studies began a nuclear threat crowdsourcing initiative called GEO for Non-Pro, which drew several hundred imagery experts together. They discovered the geolocation of North Korea's clandestine Kangsong Uranium Enrichment Facility. The new nuclear sleuths. Who's who and what's different? All of these developments have given rise to a cottage industry of non-governmental nuclear intelligence collectors and analysts. Academic teams, like my colleagues at Stanford's Center for International Security and Cooperation, bring together researchers across disciplines and former government officials. Think tanks do too. Some organizations, like Jane's and Maxar, provide commercial analysis for profit. There are advocacy groups, journalist organizations like Bellingcat, and even hobbyists. One of my favorites is Jacob Bogle, a coin dealer who lives in Tennessee and has a passion for developing detailed maps of North Korea using commercial imagery and making them available online. Taken together, this nuclear sleuthing ecosystem looks very different from the classified world of intelligence agencies. For starters, the workforces differ dramatically. The non-governmental ecosystem is wide open to anyone with an internet connection. It draws people with a grab bag of backgrounds, capabilities, and incentives. Although many are former government officials, intelligence analysts, and experts from the United States and allied countries who take their responsibilities seriously, others are amateurs with little or no training. There are currently no formal open-source training programs or quality control processes. Their motives run the gamut: informing the global public, securing nonprofit grants, selling analysis for profit, advancing a political agenda, and having fun, to name a few. Members of this ecosystem can move quickly, publishing what they want, whenever they want, without bureaucratic approvals or required vetting. I could take a random image of any landmass and say there was a unicorn training camp, and I promise you it would wind up in some form or another of publication, said Allison Puccioni, a former government imagery analyst who now works in the open source community. Non-governmental actors have access only to commercial satellite sensors. These are more numerous than spy sensors, but they offer lower quality and less capability. That's no accident. U.S. laws currently restrict the resolutions of American commercial satellites so that government satellites still have an advantage. As more foreign countries go into the commercial satellite business, however, these restrictions will confer less of an edge. The classified world looks very different from the Wild West of the non-governmental sector. Participation requires security clearances and adherence to strict government hiring and information policies. Government analysts have access to the most sophisticated spy satellites and other collection platforms, as well as commercial imagery. Analysts come with a narrower set of backgrounds, but a higher average skill level. They work inside bureaucracies with training programs, standards, and quality control mechanisms, but they move more slowly. While motives in the open source world vary, in the government they don't. The mission is clear: giving U.S. policymakers decision advantage. In short, one ecosystem is more open, diffuse, diverse, and fast-moving. The other is more closed, tailored, trained, and slower-moving. Both offer advantages. Neither is perfect.